What the If is brought to you by listeners like you, thanks to our Patreon members, patreon.com/whattheif. Go there now and find out how you can become a member and get all kinds of cool rewards. And thank you for supporting our mission for science education and science fun. Welcome to What the If. This music may be coming to you from space. Imagine. That's just a tease of our If today. With me, as always, as usual, as almost always, because we've all been bouncing in and out of the studio lately. Matthew Stanley, professor from New York University. How are you, sir?
I am here this time, so that's yes. Good. it's spring break here, so I've been getting a little more sleep, so that's been kind of nice.
Oh, now getting a lot of sleep, that doesn't sound like spring break. Not the spring break I knew at University of Maryland.
It is a spring break for old men. involves sleep and cleaning.
That's a little-known Cormac McCarthy novel.
That's right. Not one of his most popular.
Spring break for old men. Also with us, welcome back, Gabby Panicia, virologist at Rockefeller University, soon to have a official title appended before your name. But for the moment, just Citizen Panicia. Is that right? Not for much longer.
Yeah, I'm very excited for that doctor. It's going to really, really help my evil scientist aspirations. I mean, they just don't let you into the evil scientist societies without the doctorate.
Gabby is very close to finishing her PhD at Rockefeller University. And so we're eagerly awaiting your findings, I think.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it should be fun. I in my head throughout this entire process, I've been thinking of the snake fighting portion of your PhD thesis defense, that whole article. And there's the joke about, like, if you write a good thesis, you'll have to fight a small snake. so that's what I'm hoping as far as my, you know, private defense goes. If my thesis is good, they won't murder me, and if I forgot a section, then I'm going to be unceremoniously grilled about that entire passage that was missing. So I'm trying not to fight a big snake.
Good. That's very good. That's a good plan.
And format my references correctly so that it's not venomous.
Oh, good. Good. Very good.
I think that was another caveat.
Always good to have the caveats. Also with us, we are so excited. I'm also super excited to have back in the studio, in the virtual studios, Chris Carberry, from the, if you come from somewhere, Chris, would we say from the Human to Mars? Oh, from Explore Mars.
Explore Mars. We run the Humans to Mars Summit, incidentally, coming up in early May.
Amazing. Oh, yeah. I got to get back to that at some point. that's one of the best. But so check that out, by the way. I'll just give a quick promo. Go look up the Humans to Mars Summit and sign up for that. Chris is also the author of your previous book, Alcohol in Space, which Gabby might be, you know, rereading to get ready for her post-PhD.
Oh, that's alcohol on Earth.
Technically still in space.
Well, Earth is in space.
That's good.
Also true. So it is all alcohol in space.
Chris, correct. That was a mic drop moment. Earth is also in space. Boom.
It was.
And you're here with your new book, Music in Space, which is very exciting. Tell us, how did you come to do this as your follow-up?
Well, I've always been a great fan of film scores and television scores, and I've always wanted to do some writing on it. But, you know, it was interesting just to start looking at it, how our perception of space musically has changed from era to era to era. Back in the 50s, it was more ominous with theremins and electronic music. That was how people perceived space through Hollywood. You know, as you got into the Star Trek era, it started getting more positive and orchestral again. And then, of course, the big change was in 1977 when Star Wars came on, you know, was premiered, and it just changed film scoring, you know, until now. I mean, it made a major impact. But it's still be evolving over time, and it does actually impact our perception of space. And so it's just, I thought it might be interesting for a book, plus to talk about when music really has gone into space. So I talk about that as well.
It's super cool. And we're going to hear, I'm sure, as we do this, we'll get some nice tidbits from the book. And we'll talk more about it afterwards, but it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble at the moment. So check it out, Music in Space by Chris Carberry. And that leads us to our if. So Matt, if you could help us, help those who are new in the audience, perhaps, understand, Chris comes in with a book, and somehow we are transforming that into a Gedanken. What's it called? A Gedanken experiment?
A Gedanken experiment, yeah.
Yeah, a thought experiment. How do we do that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes you find yourself dissatisfied with your life, and you imagine it could be otherwise. Here, we're dissatisfied with reality. So we change it to suit our whims, at least for an hour or so. So Chris has brought in the raw material with which we will construct our new reality. And then we go inhabit that for a little bit and make ourselves feel better about our universe.
Indeed, indeed. And Gabby, there's some safety protocols people should enact or adhere to as we approach. We're about to announce a loud klaxon sound, although it sounds more like a game show theme, speaking of music. But what safety protocols should people adhere to and why?
Yeah, whenever we change the universe just a little bit, you should probably gear up mentally, physically. For this one, I guess we're going into space, so you might want to don your assorted astronaut gear. Or not, if you want to become a human raisinette. Really up to you,
raisinettes,
I think.
Raisinettes are great.
Indeed, indeed. And since it involves music, I might say you might also want to put on, you know, either a sparkly gown or an all-white leisure suit. You know, depending
done.
On it's ready to go. As we ask and we announce the thought experiment for today, we say to the universe, what the if? We were aliens living on another planet. We haven't been to space, but we have TV. We have a SETI program. This is a long if, not one of our concise ones, see. We have a SETI program, and we can receive television from space. We're watching TV from Earth throughout the decades, and we're seeing movies about space that take place in space that we think are documentaries. Documentaries called Star Trek, documentaries called Star Wars, who knows, all kinds of different things. And we're taking notes for our own science. Our scientists are watching these television programs from Earth, and they're deriving what space might be like based on these Earth movies, which are filled with music, as it turns out. Chris, yeah.
In fact, that's the plot for Galaxy Quest.
Yeah,
is that right?
Close.
I don't remember that. That's funny. Oh, right. They were watching, and then they built their spaceships like Star Trek and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's excellent. Well, never surrender. Isn't that what they say?
Never surrender.
Galaxy. Mm-hmm. So, Chris, what might be, actually, let's just go back. I don't know. Do you go back before the television age? Do you go back to like the silent era?
I go back beyond before the sound era.
Yeah.
Because the soundtracks or rather scores for films started actually quite a ways before they actually created sound films.
Right.
And so in the 1920s particularly, sound, you know, films for scores started actually in the aughts in like 1908. But
amazing.
In the 1920s, particularly in Germany, there was quite a few scores written to try to first cover the sound of the projectors, which were very loud. But a lot of the directors felt that a film score could help really, you know, amplify the film, kind of bring out some of the emotions, kind of move the action forward. And so a couple of them in particular in Germany, in the kind of the Weimar era in Germany, there was actually probably the first documentary about space, I think, that it was ever done, called Our Heavenly Bodies. It was done, and the name is actually in German, but don't ask me to say it in German. But a composer, well-known composer at the time, Ignaz Vagholder, you know, wrote the music for it. He was an accomplished opera composer at the time, and basically did this full score, which has been lost to the ages right now. But I spoke to his grandson, David Green, who mentioned that since he did opera, he would have likely written a big romantic score in the Wagnerian style, you know, trying making themes for different characters, even though it was a documentary. And so this was really the start of the science fiction, even though this was a documentary, but it was kind of science fiction at the time, film scoring age. And then 2 years later, an even bigger production, you probably all heard of Metropolis, a Fritz Lang production. That had a score as well. Gottfried Huppertz, another very well-known composer, wrote a full score. And when it premiered in Berlin in 1927, had a 66-piece orchestra to accompany the film. This was the age when they actually had, with the big fancy theaters, that often have a big orchestra as well, but rarely was played in the U.S. And then during, you know, World War II came up soon thereafter, and that score was lost until very recently, and still not the entire score that was recovered. So even before we had sound in films, film composers were kind of interpreting what space would be like, you know, through music.
So did so space cool. sound like Weimar Germany? Isn't it? It's like cabaret.
It did not. It sounded more, it's actually more like that Wagnerian sort of style. It was late romantic music, kind of similar to what John Williams reintroduced with Star Wars.
Yeah, I was going to say, oddly enough, it comes full circle around in the 70s.
It does.
So we aliens are on this planet. Matt, do you have a name? What's the name of our planet?
Well, it's a good question. It should be something thematically appropriate. Oh, so we don't know, we don't know space exists, so it's probably a really cloudy planet. So let's call it Seattle. Seattle. Seattle 9.
That's good. Seattle 9.
We're from the planet Seattle 9.
So we're sitting on Seattle 9. We're drinking our coffee. And we're watching television from our giant radio telescope that's getting the TV reception because some channel on Earth is broadcasting this old movie. And so what kind of music? So we're hearing this Wagnerian music. And so what were the images of space in that movie? Do you know? Like what images might we see on the TV with this Wagnerian music under it?
Well, you know, you've probably seen scenes from Metropolis, which technically was not a space movie. Right. It was science fiction. It was on Earth. But, you know, it was actually fairly high end for the time with early special effects. And with that, with our heavenly bodies, they also were one of the first to do special effects. They spent a huge amount of money for a documentary in 1925. And so their perception of how, you know, planetary motion and the laws of physics. And so there was animations and other things. So both of them were actually, you know, given that this was the mid-1920s, were pretty impressive. But, you know, it didn't necessarily look like reality. So I don't know what the inhabitants of Seattle 9 would think, that things didn't quite look real.
Oh, but see, they don't know because they live under we live under the clouds.
Yeah.
That's true. That's true. Mm-hmm. And so this may have looked real and it just evolved over time. I don't know how, but.
So what's the next movie that comes as we go chronologically forward or next movie or yeah, that you touch
first,
on?
First space movie that I found that actually in the sound age was basically a musical comedy science fiction musical.
Oh, wow.
redundant there saying musical, but regardless, called Just Imagine. It wasn't a very good movie, but it depicted the futuristic year 1980 when people no longer had names, they had numbers. Babies came out of vending machines.
Nice.
And you couldn't get married unless you had to apply to a tribunal, you know, to get married, and they had to approve it, because if you hadn't accomplished enough in your society, you couldn't marry the person you wanted. And it was kind of this weird tale of these three people going to Mars to kind of show that they had accomplished enough so they could get married, including a guy who'd been struck by lightning in 1930 and frozen. Well, he got struck by lightning during the backswing of a golf game and was frozen and reawakened in 1980, and was part of this really weird group that went off to Mars. The music wasn't great. It was just kind of popular music, kind of hokey music at the time, but it was a very bizarre concept, and I don't think anybody's tried a musical comedy science fiction epic again.
Yeah, think about that.
Seems very hat on the hat. Right. They just kind of keep adding things.
So the first bad lesson that we learn is that if you get struck by lightning, you may be frozen. You know,
that's right.
Important lesson. We change the rules of our golf courses, you know, just because we're afraid people are going to get frozen. So the music, Matt, you're watching. You are a resident of Seattle 9. And you're watching, you don't know anything about space. And so you're watching this documentary coming in, which has, first of all the people, it sounds like all the people are fairly happy and they're singing. So you think, well, space travel must be a joy. But secondly, the music is, you're saying, Chris, what was it? It's sort of like popular, is it sort of Gilbert and Sullivan style?
It's kind of the popular, similar, but popular 1930 music. If you just think about what sound of that, with, kind of goofy sounding singers. I like a lot of music in that era, but this is really kind of not the highest end music. And they're not singing necessarily, just playing in the background. And so they are all very happy. But it's a very weird environment. And they actually take a lot of the imagery that had been in Metropolis. It was obviously, the imagery was definitely inspired by Metropolis, but they tried to make it more positive, if you can think about getting babies out of vending machines and this whole system being a positive thing.
All right. Well, actually, the fact that there's similarity between these is actually helpful for our understanding, because that consistency suggests that actually is what space sounds like, right? It's not just an arbitrary soundtrack, but there actually is that particular style of music out there. That would give me great confidence that we've got the correct image.
Yeah, and Gabby, do you think you might start to wonder, is there something about space that makes people sing, or something about the future, or the people of Earth? Something about this. It seems like they're all singing.
I guess, are they singing throughout the entire?
No, they're not actually singing. I think there actually is a little singing. Forgive me. I've only watched it really briefly once, just for a small part of the book. But it's not really this. There is singing, but it's mostly just background music from the age. It's just kind of this goofy, happily we go off to Mars to prove ourselves, somebody can get married.
So even better. It sounds like. Go ahead.
I mean, I would absolutely guess that. Yeah. Maybe this is just some race of us, people on another planet that just absolutely has to have music on at all times. That it's so central to everything about the way that they live that, in movies, right? Like different places sometimes have different soundtracks or different leaf motifs associated with them. They really, whatever this group of people is, they really make a lot of soundtracks specifically for locations. That's how you could tell where they are.
That's really interesting, because that's actually pretty true. I think that's pretty much how it is. I think we do, we certainly listen to music a lot. A lot of people do anyway. I certainly do. It says something about the emotions too. I wonder how, we can imagine in this thought experiment that we residents of Seattle 9, our emotions are affected in the same way the Earthlings are by the music, right?
Well, actually, that's a pretty important point. Is the aesthetics of music universal in this way? you know, even here on Earth, people disagree about whether you get the same emotional resonance from, say, traditional Chinese music from traditional European music. So we're assuming that the residents of Seattle 9 have a similar auditory emotional connection.
Well, particularly since most of what they will hear are the Western films, this Western music, mm-hmm. which is ingrained in us. You mm-hmm. know, the composers do know how to affect our emotions. There are triggers, musical triggers they've been using. For instance, you know, in Metropolis was the first, first off, he used a bit of the French national anthem, you know, talk about, you know, show, you know, the rise of the workers. And then he also was the first time using Dies Irae in A Day of Wrath, dun, 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 which has been used throughout film history. And it's basically a trigger, you know, to think something bad is going to happen, you know. And so mm-hmm. that was used, you know, in there to depict the bad guy. And so all these sorts of process, you know, triggers, thing, you know, have been used through the ages. I use the example of, you know, which has been used by a lot of people, but imagine a meadow with a little girl running through the meadow. If you have happy, bouncy music, uplifting music, oh, it's just a wonderful scene. If you trade that out with kind of sinister sounding music, you know, something bad's going to happen. It's kind of like the beginning of The Shining. We're moving away from space here. But the music for The Shining is actually Dies Irae. Dun, 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 dun. And it's a nice scene, but it's, you know, you can tell this is going to be something bad's going to happen, because through this beautiful scene, they're driving through the mountains, you have this ominous music. And so these aliens of Seattle 9, even if they hadn't perceived their emotions this way, we may have actually changed how they musically perceive their emotions. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the proper way. If I'm feeling scared, this is the proper soundtrack for my fear. If I'm feeling just inspired, you know, this kind of Aaron Copland sound might be the sound that, you know, they realize is the proper soundtrack for their emotions.
Oh, that's interesting. By the way, I got to mention with Metropolis, about a month ago, I saw Metropolis performed, projected at the New York Philharmonic with just an organ accompaniment. So one guy at an organ, and he played for like, and he had, I forget his name, but he had composed the score, a new score for it, and which sounded very traditional, but, and he sat there and he played for like 2.5 hours straight on the organ. And it was phenomenal to see it with like this music. So look, if you're interested in this kind of thing, look around, because there are, and there's a number of series that do go around from city to city where they are showing movies. I've seen Star Wars performed with the New York Philharmonic, and Close Encounters, and there's different times occasionally they'll do these things. So Chris, what's the next movie that where music really plays a interesting role?
I think probably, and we don't want to spend too much time in the early days, but Things to Come, and we can do a time leap after this anyway. Things to Come, which Arthur Bliss, later Sir Arthur Bliss, famous British composer, wrote the theme. Things to Come was basically based on a book by H.G. Wells, and H.G. Wells was actually actively part of the film and actually recruited Arthur Bliss and promised Arthur Bliss that he should write the music the way he wanted to, and they will bend the movie to the music. Of course, the director and the producer hadn't been told about this, and of course that plan was scuttled, you know, really irritating Arthur Bliss. And you know, they had to bring in a music editor later, once again, starting all these processes that we use commonly now to adjust the film, to adjust the score to match the film. But Arthur Bliss was not happy, neither was H.G. Wells, but it was still one of these. It was a fairly cutting edge movie, you know, involving space, you know, basically post-apocalyptic Earth, where they manage to rise up again, bring themselves back to civilization, and then send a mission to the moon.
Yeah.
And, you know, Arthur Bliss wrote the music for this. Once again, in that late romantic style of music.
Yeah. All right. So what did the Seattleians make of the fact that the soundtrack of space is changing? Is that a natural phenomenon to them? Is there something changing about the property of space itself?
Right, because let's remember, that's the bizarre, the great misinterpretation of these Seattle Ninians, is that they think that this music is actually real in the world. They what's funny is they don't understand the difference between, and this is a word, this is a big word, I'm going to get to use my master's degree in cinema studies here. There's a word called diegetic, diegetic music and non-diegetic music. Gabby is nodding with understanding. So diegetic music means it's actually in the world, right? And non-diegetic means it's score. It's just something playing outside of the world of the movie. Kind of a subtle difference. But these Seattle Ninians, they think everything is diegetic. That, oh, that's an actual recording of the music.
Well, it might be, and I think too, and this is actually a good segue, you know, because there's a major change, you know, over the next 15 years, 20 years, when you get into the 50s, where you go into this more sinister-sounding electronic, theremin-based music. But it may be because a lot of those are based on aliens invading, aliens coming down. You know, we realized not everybody's friendly in space. And now there's something to be feared by space, we've realized. And this is our emotional soundtracks have changed based on this new reality. It's not just happy days with our babies and vending machines anymore going to Mars, but people are fighting back. They're coming and invading us. So that could have just changed the whole emotional musical dynamic.
Yeah, so it sounds like music changes according to who is in the space. You know, that you change space around you. Is that right?
I was going to ask in general, like, so one of the common things in like science fiction is that, you know, it very much reflects the like hopes and fears of a group of people at a time. So it seems like early science fiction was more hopeful. Then you hit this period where we're all worried about like invasion, and that's like a common theme. And so the music changes. Does the music change more gradually, or is it that when a new sort of type of science fiction comes in vogue, there's a big jump. So all of a sudden, the sound of space changes.
Well, this particular case in our reality was actually stimulated by a very good score. It just unfortunately just changed everybody's perception and everybody copied it. Bernard Herrmann wrote the score for The Day the Earth Stood Still. And of course, was a good alien, but with a very threatening message, and reflecting basically the fear regarding potential for nuclear war. And so Bernard Herrmann just created this innovative score with a couple of theremins, a whole different, you know, unusual array of instruments as well, you know, to depict that film. But after that, every other B movie is using the theremin. They take it and use it for every crappy movie that's made during the 1950s.
And I just want to say, just so people don't remember, Day the Earth Stood Still, this is the movie where and there are other movies like this too, but you see the giant UFO on the lawn of the White House or the Capitol?
The Capitol Mall.
And there's a giant robot standing outside, Klaatu, and he has come with a message from aliens for us. Basically, an ultimatum, isn't it?
Yep, pretty much. Clean up your act or it will destroy the Earth. You know, come join the community of planets. If you don't and you become hostile, we'll blow you up.
Right.
Or use Gort. It's actually Gort's the name of the robot. You know, Gort will come and blow you up with his laser vision.
Yeah, it's going to happen sometimes.
So it seems that the theremin, the residents of Seattle 9, we must think that each species, perhaps, or something about certain species of aliens. So, first of all, we learned there are we've already known there were Earthlings, so we already knew there was life in space, right? Mm-hmm. So we know about Earth, but now we're learning from Earth movies that there's all kinds of aliens out there, and some of them make the sound of a theremin. as they
enter
the room, you know.
Okay, so that's a helpful thing for them to know, that different species come with different music, because that helps explain why it sounds different at different times. I think that begs the question of what our sound is like then, right? Once the Seattleans realize that it's a species-specific thing, we need to know what sound we're supposed to be making.
Interesting.
So are we more like Gort, or are we more like, I don't know, the robot from Metropolis?
I think we would associate with the good guys, we would think. Don't you think? Hopefully. I think we would be singing the Cole Porter.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Songs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gabby, what music would you make? What music represents you and your species?
I'm trying to think purely based on my Spotify history. It would just be a lot of EDM, which is not necessarily something that I want associated with. It does not vibe with my personality at all. I'm generally very chill, and then I take out my earbuds, and it's a song that you're meant to be listening to at the club under the influence of multiple substances. So that's not necessarily contiguous with my normal life experience. I don't know. I feel like mentally my association with like human beings and like in space is that very like brassy, like Star Wars kind of score. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe that has to do with like where my formative like space movie like experience is. Like Star Wars was very much like my formative space movie. So like the sounds of Star Wars are very much what I associate with like a space movie.
Yeah, I think so. I like the idea that perhaps Darth Vader also feels he's the music that represents him isn't really the music he would prefer, but he just can't help it. Every time he walks into a room. So
no wonder everyone's scared of me every time I come in the room.
It's this Spotify list. So Chris, let's jump to Star Wars because a lot of interesting things happen there. And tell us, how does music change there? Because it becomes basically, it almost seems like each character has their own theme, which is a very Wagnerian thing. Is that right?
Yeah, no, John Williams definitely embraced that school.
Yeah.
And a little backstory, while there were a number of orchestral film scores in the preceding 15 years, and particularly in some science fiction, orchestral film scores had gone out of fashion in major motion pictures for the previous, you know, since the early 60s. You had like The Graduate and Paul Newman and no, the cowboy one. I'm blanking right now. Sundance, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which had more popular music in it. They weren't based on big orchestral film scores, and so people had gone out of fashion, and then 1977. Yeah, John Williams comes in. George Lucas had some very clear visions of what he wanted. He was even considering doing the same thing that Stanley Kubrick did in 2001, A Space Odyssey, with actually not having an original score and placing actual pre-existing classical music. And by the way, there was actually an original score for 2001, A Space Odyssey. The composer, Alec North, didn't know they weren't using it, at least according to North, until the premiere. He attended the premiere and his music wasn't part of it. That would have really sucked.
Yeah.
But jumping forward to Star Wars, it was Steven Spielberg that convinced John Williams, or convinced George Lucas, to hire John Williams because he had, you know, worked with him on Jaws and was already working with him on Close Encounters. And said, "You've got to use this guy. You know, he'll do the most incredible job." And so he put together this quite remarkable score. Major, huge manuscript, which did, as you know, as you mentioned, it has themes for different. It's called Leitmotif. You know, themes for different characters, as well as it's not just characters. It can also be like spiritual forces, like the Force. The Force has a theme as well. You know, so, you know, each of the characters, you'll figure out most of the characters have themes, and it's a big, brassy orchestral score, and all of a sudden just changed everything, not just in science fiction, but in film scoring in general and in classical music. all of a sudden, big brassy orchestral scores became vogue. Big Hollywood, big orchestras were playing them, and just actually built up a lot of interest in classical music in general. And then everybody, particularly for science fiction, everybody had to do a big orchestral score, and it was really irritating to a lot of composers. Get all the producers saying, get as close to Star Wars as possible. That was when Jerry Goldsmith did the score for Star Trek, the motion picture. He had a lot of pressure to not only do something equal to John Williams, but make it sound as similar as possible. So trying to find that balance that was something new, but also had that same sort of gravitas, that brassy sound.
Yeah, Battlestar Galactica also.
Battlestar Galactica as well. Stu Phillips.
Oh, yeah.
They used the LA Philharmonic to actually record that thing.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
Which was very unusual for a television theme song. It was unheard of for a television theme song to use a major orchestra.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. Side note, I was just reading an article about how why the original Battlestar Galactica TV show was so important, which is something I never really, I enjoyed it, but I also thought of it as a little cheesy, but it was sort of saying that it was the first time that basically all these things that were only done in movies were done in television. Well, the special effects, the music, even the serial nature of it and things like that.
Well, in fact, the Star Wars, Fox sued the production. Because they thought it was too close to Star Wars. They even sued Stu Phillips, and they actually sent, because they thought that might be, the music might be too close, and they sent John Williams come down to listen to one of the recording sessions. John Williams thought it was just ridiculous and, said, no, there's no plagiarism here. But it was one of these things that actually led to the demise of Battlestar Galactica, amongst some other things. Mm. But the fact that there was also this lawsuit and some other things that was going against it, caused it to be canceled.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. So the Force has its own theme. So first of all, I think we Seattle Niners, first of all, learn that there's something called the Force, and we're definitely interested in that.
It
has its own theme. So we might think if we play that melody, we can use the Force. Maybe that's like an important part of using the Force, right?
Well, I should say that was certainly my reasoning when I was a little kid too, when I was playing Star Wars, had to have I had to be doing the music in the background or it didn't seem quite right. And so their version of NASA, however it comes to be, is definitely going to have a big symphonic element. I don't know what percentage of their budget is going to be for music.
There's an orchestra in Mission Control.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great idea.
We'll never get off the ground.
They really should do that, right? That would be fantastic.
I like it. Yeah.
A live score. Gabby, what?
Of course, later that. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was gonna say, Gabby, what would you, was there ever a time where you played music as you were imagining something, or what would you do with these themes?
I mean, personally, I think a thing that's really kind of funny to me is if you are like the Seattle Ninians trying to put all this together, our science fiction has varied so wildly over the years. And if you have so much science fiction to draw from, your ability to make like a continuous map of human history is going to be really branching in a way, because there's a lot of science fiction that is like near Earth future. There's not a lot of science fiction that's like current. It's always like near future for the most part, or far future.
Well, later and that so, like, year, there's a good example.
Of near future?
Science fiction? Same year, 1977. Close Encounters.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, you admittedly, like, you're going to have like those rare, precious few examples than like Close Encounters to try to construct like an accurate or like more current idea of like what humanity's actual timeline is. But then every science fiction story is its own unique, completely gonzo branch off from that. So you're like, okay, I can kind of see how, okay, apparently in this one, the entire space program collapsed if you're watching, like, I don't know, Gravity. but then you're like, and then you go and you watch, you know, Star Wars, and you're like, oh, well, they put it back together eventually. So you're trying to, like, assemble stuff. But, oh, they put their space program back together, and they got a lot better, and they got space wizards. So, the timeline that you assemble in this way must, I think, be really fascinating. Yeah. And I'm sure it's, like, the source of tremendous Seattle 9 scholarly debate. And maybe I'm thinking about this so much because I just finished reading Canticle for Leibowitz, where this is, like, partially a thing, like, using scattered bits of, like, past humanity mm-hmm. to reconstruct the past, and also sometimes getting fiction in there.
No,
and needing to figure out.
Yeah, it would be fun to see how they assembled all of the different movies in a sensible chronological order. Yeah, and then if music would be part of that as well. So all the John Williams pieces are together because they sound thematically the same, and they have to make sense of how Close Encounters and Star Wars are happening at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Of course, Close Encounters is a whole different sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah, exactly,
he uses totally more contemporary, yeah. more avant-garde sounds for Close Encounters. Yeah. Yeah. Create the impression that the alien visitors might be nefarious. It's a musical misdirect until the end, and then you realize, oh, they're friendly. And you know, and he also incorporates When You Wish Upon a Star into the score at the end. Yeah. And so I don't know how they'd interpret, you know, this whole process, you know, the musical evolution of Close Encounters. Oh, it does introduce a wonderful theme that you communicate with aliens through music. Yes.
That's the most incredible thing. And I think, by the way, Close Encounters is one of the best movies ever made. It's my favorite movie. And that idea, spoiler alert, but near the end of Close Encounters, it becomes that the aliens teach humans how to communicate, and they do that through music. You know, and so the residents of Seattle 9 must really take that to heart and wonder why it never comes up again in any other movie. Clearly, it must be a bad thing, you know.
Well, it's subconscious. It's part of that soundtrack.
That's true. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know,
it helps explain why there's music going on.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. We're communicating. So the last thing is, let's just end with. I just want to know how close to the present do you go? Like, where is movie music at right now?
Well, I'm pretty close to the current. You know, I talk about Dune a little bit. I talk about probably the most impressive television show for music, which is actually The Orville that Seth MacFarlane put together. It regularly has a 90-piece orchestra. He has 3 or 4 full-time composers. Wow. He went all in and also went in with the theme music. To counter because of streaming and everything and everybody's tendency when they're binging is to skip intro, you know, skip over the theme music. So people are just now creating these like short riffs, you know, with the theme. But he's gone against that. They starting off with a 60 second full orchestral intro. And then for the last season, He buckled down. He went to a 90-second big grand opening theme music. And so the whole series is heavily orchestrated using several composers, drawing on themes, or at least the sounds like Jerry Goldsmith or John Williams, a little bit of David Arnold, and many others. So MacFarlane is obsessed with film music and apparently has a photographic memory for like every imaginable film score. So all of his, even like the animated things he does tend to have a huge, huge orchestra based compared to everybody else. But the Orville, he went all in with the music. And so it is very high quality orchestral music. Similar, if you listen to it, you'll hear similarities to different things because they are literally basing it off. And if you listen, I don't know if you know what a temp track is, basically the music that the director puts in to say, I want something that sounds like this. I want something that sounds like this. And the temp track is usually made up of other film scores or classical pieces. And, you know, listening to it, thinking, oh, I hear Indiana Jones here. Oh, I hear the Empire. Oh, I hear, Star Trek, the motion picture. So it's original, but you can also tell what the source music originally had been, because apparently McFarlane also likes, you know, pushes for get it as close to this as you can without plagiarizing.
So, oh, that's awesome. Wow. I got to check out the Orville. I have not seen that. Matt, it seemed like
I saw an episode or two. I'm familiar with it.
Gets better as it goes.
Is that right?
Along.
Okay, yeah. I hear people.
Yeah, at the beginning, they weren't quite play. You could tell they weren't quite sure where they were going, and it just really turned more into something similar to Next Generation, but with the license to be completely outrageous. So a lot of serious plots, a lot of interesting stories, but occasional complete zaniness. So,
yeah, I heard a lot of people saying it was the best Star Trek series on at the moment.
I agree with that.
That's
of the ones out these days.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, thank you, Chris. This has been a great exploration. Gabby, how do we wrap up? How do the Seattle Niners they put together a thesis? They write up their study of everything they've seen. What conclusion do they come to?
Yeah, well, I think in typical Seattle Nine fashion, they have a musical score with a vocal accompaniment to close out the episode. So, I mean, for us participating in that, we all say the name of the show very slow, like together in unison in slow motion. So Seattle Nineians have struck up their band, and if you will join me in closing out today's episode...
What the if?
Thank you all for listening, and a special shout out to the What the If players who bring us the best science fiction music every day, every week. Chris, thank you so much. Again, the book is Music in Space. You can get it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And don't forget Chris's other book, Alcohol in Space, also available everywhere. And the documentary coming out soon. Keep an eye out for that. Thank you. Awesome to have you back, Chris. Patreon supporters are going to get a special bonus extra extended episode. If you're a Patreon supporter, you're going to hear from Chris. We're going to talk a little bit more. We're going to find out about what does music sound like if you try to play it in real space. We'll get a little hint of that, and maybe we'll talk about Hans Zimmer, another classic science fiction composer. So much more to talk about just for Patreon supporters. If you don't know what Patreon is or what our membership program is, go check it out. Patreon.com/whattheif. All kinds of fun merch there and more. We'll see you next week.